It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk with the only person who has raced in every Birkebeiner ski competition since it started in 1973. Now, today is the third day of confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, the first black woman in history nominated, potentially the first to be confirmed, to the U.S. Supreme Court. Members of the Senate Judiciary Committee have brought up a wide variety of topics, including the historic nature of Judge Jackson's nomination, her take on the First Amendment, and hot-button conservative talking points, including critical race theory and gender. We're talking about the Supreme Court confirmation hearings of Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching or listening to the hearings? What has stood out to you? What do you want from a Supreme Court nominee? What do you want to hear from senators in these confirmation hearings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Liebel is professor of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. Susan, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here, Rob.
What has stood out to you over the 2 days so far?
Wow. The tone has just been like a ping pong match in which it moves from sort of exceedingly hostile, interrupting, back to a kind of a, pitch the ball firmly over the plate and try to get the nominee to explain some of what might not have been explained or misunderstood during the more combative questioning. That stood out to me. And I guess, though, the manner in which she has been interrupted yet remained composed, I think that those two things for the moment are something that stood out to me.
Judge Jackson talked about her views on judicial transparency, her belief that regular people should be able to understand the courts, referencing her background as a public defender earlier in her career.
What I decided as a trial judge was that I was going to make sure that everyone who was in my courtroom, and especially the defendant, understood all of the procedures that we were going through, all of the steps. I spoke directly to them. I asked them, do you understand what's happening?
Can you talk a little bit about what Judge Jackson was saying there and her background as a public defender, which is fairly unique these days on a U.S. Supreme Court?
Oh, it's quite unique. The last one that we know of was Thurgood Marshall. So it's been quite a while. I think that she is trying very hard to take these questions that are sometimes very technical and case specific and translate them into an understanding of her wider approach to the law, which tends to focus on due process and how the adversarial system, how making an argument that you might not agree with is part of what makes the American system unique and, in her eyes, admirable. So I think that she's walking a fine line. On the one hand, she's trying to answer very specific questions. At the same time, she's trying to be understood by the American public.
There's a couple different ways of looking at a Supreme Court justice. I think in the public, commonly, and in the media, we often think liberal or conservative on our current American scale. But there are issues of judicial philosophy that different lawyers, different judges may hold. What are you seeing from Judge Jackson when it comes to those two scales of judgment?
Well, first of all, I think we found out that she really doesn't like the term judicial philosophy, and she prefers methodology. I think what we've learned about her in these hearings is actually she's a very moderate judge. Critical race theory has come up a lot, but she's actually the opposite of critical race theory. And from the left, there would be a lot to criticize in the approach that she takes. She's very comfortable with elements of originalism and history. Again, I think that may have been a bit of a surprise to people who were listening to the hearings. And also she rejected acceptance of looking at international law, which is something that Justice Kennedy from the right and Justice Breyer from the left did. I mean, she seemed to almost be supporting originalism yesterday.
And remind us what originalism is.
Originalism purports to create a neutral stance. So it says that the Constitution was written by two sets of framers, you know, at the time of the founding in the 18th century, and then the refounding of the nation after the Civil War. And that what we should do is look back to the original understanding of those framers and the public that they were speaking to. And that is often put forward as a neutral way of understanding the law, as opposed to a living constitution, which means that we interpret the words as we would today.
We are looking at the Supreme Court nomination hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Susan Liebel is with us, professor of political science at St. Joseph University in Philadelphia. You could join in with your thoughts on what you've seen and heard so far, your questions about the process, about the Supreme Court itself. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, if, as I mentioned earlier, if she's confirmed, Judge Jackson would be the first Black woman in history on the U.S. Supreme Court. She talked a little bit about the historic nature of her nomination.
I stand on the shoulders of so many who have come before me, including Judge Constance Baker Motley, who was the first African-American woman to be appointed to the federal bench and with whom I share a birthday. And like Judge Motley, I have dedicated my career to ensuring that the words engraved on the front of the Supreme Court building, equal justice under law, are a reality and not just an ideal.
Susan, how are senators from both parties treating the historic nature of the nomination?
Well, it's been radically different. She's receiving a lot of kudos from the Democratic members of the committee, a lot of space to explain her views, some specific questions about particular pet peeves of the Democratic senators. But she's been challenged very stridently by Senators Cruz, by Senator Hawley, by Senator Graham, and others in ways that we've come to expect sometimes in these hearings, but really pushed to the edge of the kind of combativeness.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Randy is with us in Preston, Minnesota. Randy, hi.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just listening to Josh Hawley's current round of questioning, and it seems to me his goal is to get the nominee to strike out and tell him what a jerk he is, to try and undermine, you know, and then that'll be the lead of all the papers and all the news, that, oh, she flipped out and she told Josh Hawley he was a jerk. I would have used more colorful language. But, yeah, he didn't really want to answer. He just keeps going as the same hot button. It's all about sentencing of people convicted of pornography. But I just read a book by a judge, Jeb Radoff, I think was his name, and it's Why the Innocent Plead Guilty and the Guilty and the Rich Go Free. And what they do to people is the prosecutors throw a million charges, and then they say, we'll cut you a deal. If you plead guilty to the one thing and you'll only get this, they make these deals. And so people say, well, if I don't plead guilty and I go to court, I go to a trial and I lose, I could go for 20 years.
I gotcha. Randy, to Randy's point about, for example, Senator Hawley's question, that idea of a kind of a trying to get theater, trying to get a moment in there. Even Republican Senator Ben Sasse referred to the I'll clean up his language, but basically a theatrical nature of some of the questioning. What do you think about what Randy had to say, Susan?
Yeah, he said mugging for the cameras. I think Randy is right about the baiting. So the hope is to disturb her composure. And as you see, she carefully keeps her hands folded. She doesn't move her body very much. She occasionally furrows her brow, but very little. And I guess I would go a little bit, and I agree with you as well, that this is, as Senator Sasse said, mugging for the cameras. But I think it's actually more. I think what we're also seeing is a kind of a racial dog whistle politics, in which what the senators are trying to suggest is that Black Americans are criminals, that Black lawyers are supportive of criminal behavior, so that somehow she is somebody who is not tough enough. But I don't think it's simply about toughness. I think that there's something else going on there in terms of a bias, a suggestion, for example, that neutrality, that she lacks neutrality. And I think there she's being asked to prove that she's not biased because of her gender and her race.
Randy, thanks for that call. Go to Fawn next in Madison. Fawn, hello.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to comment on Judge Brown Jackson's utter composure in the parts of the hearings that I have witnessed. She just maintained such equanimity, like such a sanguinity, just calm composure. It's such grace under pressure that is just makes me admire her to the hilt. And I wish that she would make a model Supreme Court justice, in my opinion. In fact, I wish she were on our state Supreme Court for the same reason. But she, her behavior and her composure, her grace, her intelligence, and her measured responses were nothing short of exemplary. I wish the same could be said for some of those senators.
Fawn, thanks for the call. Susan, you were just talking about some of that equanimity. Do you want to expand on what Fawn had to say?
No, I think Fawn is right, and there's been a lot of commentary, especially from professional Black women, talking about mansplaining and patronizing, and that this is something that you are watching her endure. Even the senators who are supporting her are often patronizing her. She's being told, like, you're a role model. She is, in a sense, the suggestion is she must prove that she is an exemplary American because of both her race and her gender. And I agree with Fawn that what we see is somebody who's being patronized, but is enduring being condescended to, interrupted, referred to as her and she. And that's really important because often it is the case that honorifics are denied Black professionals and women professionals. And we see that intersection here as she's called her and she instead of judge.
Fawn, thanks for the call. We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph University, talking to us about Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson's confirmation hearings ongoing this week. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. What has stood out to you if you've been watching, listening to, and or reading up on this process, on the judge and her nomination for this seat on the U.S. Supreme Court? Your questions about Judge Jackson's credentials, background, where she might fit into the future of a Supreme Court if confirmed, 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with St. Joseph's University political science professor and chair Susan Liebel about the Supreme Court confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your reactions. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sarah joins us next in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Rob. You know, can I just comment super quick on what you were just talking about her composure? And because she is being so nice, and I realize that, like, she feels like she has to be that nice, but they're being so mean to her. And she's like, yes, yes, yes. She's, like, so nice. And I wish she could just, like, be a little more, like, not so nice. But and compare that to Brett Kavanaugh, who was just frothing at the mouth. He was so angry. But, okay, so my question is, do they really have a goal? Do you think they really have a goal, the Republicans, of thinking they could get enough votes to defeat her? Or are they just trying to discredit her for, like, the future court decisions that she'll make? Or are they just trying to look good for their voters?
Sarah, thanks for the call. Interesting question. Is the goal to derail the nomination? Is it to score political points, maybe in an election, midterm election year? What do you think, Susan?
It's a great question, Sarah, and there's been amazing work in political science done on anger and who's allowed to be angry. And she's not allowed to be angry. She has to remain that composed, or she will be criticized as either being shrill as a woman or being an angry Black woman. All of these stereotypes will be applied to her. I think her goal is to get herself confirmed. And the way the numbers work is that the Democrats have enough, if they can hold Manchin and Sinema in this vote for Vice President Harris, to then break the tie. They don't need any Republican votes. They're hoping to have some. And I think that they hoped that the three people who had voted for her the last time she was appointed federal judge, which was Lisa Mikulski and actually Senator Graham from South Carolina and Susan Collins from Maine. But it's not looking like the senator from South Carolina will be voting in her favor. He seems very, very hostile. But they don't need those votes. She hopes for them, but she doesn't need them.
Sarah, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us now in Elkhorn. Tim, hi.
Yes, the line of questioning now any different than the line of questioning that the previous Supreme Court candidates have had?
Tim, thanks for the call. His line broke up a little there. Tim saying, is this really that much different than past confirmation processes? These can be pretty heated.
So look, most of our history, it was simply advise and consent. There weren't long hearings. There was a voice vote. It was extremely rare for the Senate to reject the president's pick. It occasionally was about competence. President Nixon nominated two judges that did not get good ratings from the American Bar Association. And he famously said, there's a lot of mediocre people, so why don't we have some mediocre judges? And then had to nominate somebody else. Since the Bork hearings in 1987, in which Reagan was overturned, there has been some rancor. Although after Bork, we really saw this settle down. And most of the justices had been unanimously or close to unanimously, put on the bench, including Ruth Bader Ginsburg and people who we might think of as more controversial. So I think what we're seeing is right now is a relitigating of past rancor, rancor from the Republicans over the Kavanaugh hearings, rancor from the Democrats in the Republicans not holding a hearing on Merrick Garland. And I think we're seeing a reflection of where our Senate's politics stand right now. There is not a lot of cooperation. And so the way I would place this, Tim, is to say it is extraordinary. And we've very recently had this departure, and we should think about our entire Democratic history, I think, when we judge the kind of behavior that we're seeing in the last couple of days.
Talking to Tim and Elkhorn, thanks for calling in. We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, political scientist there, looking at the ongoing confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Susan, what is it about these Supreme Court confirmation that's gotten so divisive? Is it just, you were touching on this a little bit, the Senate in general getting more partisan? Is there something about a higher stakes at the U.S. Supreme Court? What's going on?
It's funny, there is no stakes actually in this confirmation. I mean, it's a 6-3 conservative majority. Even if Chief Justice Roberts occasionally votes with the liberals, that is still not enough to be a majority. So this is the most solidly conservative court that we've seen in modern history. So there isn't anything at stake. And I agree with what I think you said earlier, or one of the callers, that some of this is playing out the midterms, the 2020 vote for the presidency. I think we're seeing Republicans, for example, Cruz and Sass, position themselves in different ways. What should a Republican look like? So I think it's extremely complicated. And look, it's happened before. A couple of the justices have mentioned Hugo Black, who was appointed in the late 30s by FDR. But there was a problem with his nomination. It was rumored that he was in the Ku Klux Klan. And because we didn't have the internet and all the documentation that we have, it wasn't confirmed until after he was confirmed that, in fact, he had been a member. Now, he went on to be a justice who did much for civil rights. But, the kind of information wasn't available. And occasionally we did see very, very serious challenges to justices who were imagined to not be able to fulfill their duty on the bench.
What are you watching for as this goes forward now? The Judiciary Committee will finish up. What are you watching for in the rest of the process?
I'm watching to see just how far Cruz and others are willing to go on race baiting and repeating the child pornography material. I personally found it strange to hear them saying it over and over and over again, as they really seem to have established their point already. So they really seem to try to be rehearsing something. I don't think we're going to learn much more new about what anyone on the committee thinks. And I think it's just going to be watching the judge remain calm.
That child pornography angle, they have mentioned her sentences given to people who viewed child pornography. She points out within congressionally set guidelines, people have done stats. Her charges or her sentences are within the norm, as I understand it. So why this particular line of attack just in our last minute or so?
I think this is just trying out what issues can possibly make people uncomfortable and stop any Republican who was thinking about crossing party lines and being unified behind the first Black woman and a highly qualified person. I think the last thing I'd say is I don't actually think she's unusual. She's has the same education and very, very similar corporate law background, et cetera, than almost everybody who is on the Supreme Court. And she's had very, very similar jobs as a judge. So in some ways, she was a very moderate, conservative candidate. And it's interesting to watch her being made into a radical, which she absolutely is not.
Susan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're welcome. It was terrific.
Susan Liebel is professor and chair of political science at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. She talked to us today about the ongoing confirmation hearings for Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court. Keep following the news at WPR.org. We'll have reporting there from our colleagues at NPR. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, we can face ethical dilemmas in our everyday lives, but how can we resolve those dilemmas? A Wisconsin ethics expert joins the show with advice, and you could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences dealing with those conundrums in your own life. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you're feeling okay today, it's time to celebrate because it's the anniversary of the word or abbreviation, okay. As reported at history.com, this day in 1839 marks the first known use of okay in print in the Boston Morning Post. And what did okay stand for? All correct. Wait, wouldn't that be AC? Usually, yeah. But there was a cool slang thing at the time among the hipsters of the day where you intentionally misspelled words and phrases, so all correct was spelled all correct with an O and a K. Now okay has become one of the most commonly used words on the planet, even crossing language boundaries. And it all started with the cool kid meme of the day. What will stand the test of time in today's youth talk? Good soup. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, 2021 saw a significant drop in bankruptcy filings. We'll find out what impact that had on the economy. Now, our next guest has skied in every single American Birkebeiner ski race. That's right. At the age of 74, Ernie St. Germain has never missed the annual cross-country ski race in northern Wisconsin since it started in 1973. The Birkebeiner is the largest North American ski race. Ernie is considered one of its founders. Ernie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Can you take us back to 1973? Tell us a little bit about the origins of the race and how you got into it.
Well, the community around Hayward, there were a lot of Norwegians. There's a lot of real strong culture here of many Norwegians. And course, Tony Wise, who had Telmark and Historyland and log rolling and started many things in Hayward, invited a skier from Norway to come over in 1972 and start developing ski trails. And he did. And the very next year, in order to keep promoting Nordic skiing, because he had an alpine downhill ski area to promote Nordic skiing, they decided they would do a race that is fashioned after the Norwegian Birkebeiner in Norway. And that race, they ski from one town over a mountain to the next town, and that's 55 kilometers. And then the next year they ski back in the other direction. And so each year they ski back and forth. And so Tony decided, well, we can do that. We can, we have the, we don't have a mountain, but we have some amazing hills between Telmark Lodge up in Cable and Hayward. And so he decided to have this, this race and got the word out. And I'm not one of those old Norwegians, wanted to do the race himself. And his wife says, absolutely not. You're 72 years old and you are not going to ski that race. And his name was Lyman Williamson. And he looked at me and he said, my boy, Edna won't let me ski it. So you're going to have to represent me. And I said, sure, nothing to it. I had no idea what I was getting into.
You did it the first race. Did you think that was it?
I swore up and down I would never do anything so foolish.
What did you feel like after you completed it for the first time?
I was in, you know, I was in good shape. I was an athlete. My body was fine. The only thing that wasn't were the balls of my feet. And, you know, your heel is not attached in a Nordic binding. So your foot flexes at the toes and the ball of the foot as you stride on the skis. And my foot, my feet were just not prepared for that. And my body did fine, but the balls of my feet, oh my goodness. I had to crawl for 3 days. I had a hard time walking.
All right, now hang on, Ernie. You're a proxy for a 72-year-old, you just said. You're 74, and you're still skiing the Berkey, including this year. Now, how do you feel after doing that at 74?
You know, when I was 72 years old skiing the race, I thought of Lyman just almost every K. I thought of him, and every year I thank him for, you know, telling me I had to represent him. That night, Tony Wise had an awards banquet at that first year up at Telmark. And I came back to the house, to Lyman's house, and sat down on the couch and then slowly laid down on the couch and fell asleep. And about 6 o'clock, he came and woke me up and he said, come on, my boy, we have to go up to the awards banquet. And I looked at him and I said, Lyman, you're going to have to represent me. But Tony Wise was an entrepreneur, and he was just an amazing person. He put Hayward and Cable on the map with the many things that he did, brought tourism to the area, kept it alive. And the Birkebeiner, that first year, there were 35 of us that lined up on the line. And this year, the 48th race, there were about 12,000 skiers that,
wow,
you know, skied in all the events. So he had a vision of it growing to be an amazing event. And although he didn't, you know, live long enough to see this 12,000 skiers, we all think of him every year.
We got an email from a William Johnson who says, hi, Ernie, missed visiting you with you when you skied through the gravel pit at the Berkey this year. And William says, tell us about the spectacle of the earlier Berkeys with torch runs, flaming cauldrons, and opening ceremonies with national anthems in front of the Telmark Coliseum.
Oh, my. Yeah, the Coliseum was quite a place. We would finish our races there in front of the Coliseum. And the opening ceremonies, which were usually on Thursday, included a parade of nations. And all the nations that came from all over the world had a sign with their, you know, just like the Olympics. But then all of the states also, so skiers could group up with their state and march into the Coliseum from outside. It was amazing. And there was always a torch lighting to open the games and music. And it was a festival atmosphere that has carried over to the American Birkbeiner Foundation that keeps that energy and that spirit alive. The foundation and the staff just does an amazing job keeping this going.
Ernie, I got to ask you something. I'm thinking it's on a lot of people's minds. What is your training / exercise routine to keep you doing this year after year?
Well, I have two more to go to reach 50. And this year, I skied my race on Wednesday during the open track in absolutely perfect conditions. It was an amazing day. And so on Thursday, my grandson skied in the Barn Burkey, and I was there with him. And, you know, I'm on skis the next day. My training for next year has started already.
Wow.
It starts the next. I, you know, skied not a lot. Some people are still out looking for snow to ski. That's not me. I just stay active. I ride my bike. I hike. I'm always doing something outside. The fresh air and the sunshine is an amazing healer. Amazing. Gives us strength. And I believe it got me through COVID, as well as all the vaccines and everything else, you know, the masks. I followed that religiously. I didn't take any chances because I can't afford to get sick. But I believe that the fresh air and the sunshine played a huge part in that, just being outside and being active.
Ernie, I'll let you get back to training. Thanks so much for joining us today.
I enjoyed it, and thank you again for inviting me, and thank all the listeners.
That's Ernie St. Germain, who has skied the American Birkbeiner every single event since it was founded back in 1973. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a look into how Wisconsin became the Badger State.
We recently received a listener question in the Wisconsin mailbag. Michael from Dane County asked, why is the badger Wisconsin's state animal? WPR's John K. Wilson went digging to find out more.
Wisconsin is the Badger State. It's on the flag, it's the mascot of the state's biggest university, and back in 1957, lawmakers put the badger into state law as Wisconsin's official animal. But why? Badgers live in plenty of states, and they're pretty rare here. It's not like you see them running around willy-nilly like squirrels. To get some answers, I figured why not start by going straight to the source. Bucky, pretty common name for badgers, I guess, is the resident education badger at Henry Vilas Zoo in Madison. He goes on field trips and teaches kids about nature, so maybe he'd have something to tell me. On a recent morning, I talked with him in his enclosure while he was eating a hard-boiled egg. Hi, Bucky. John K. Wilson with WPR. Can I ask you a few questions? Do you know why the badger is Wisconsin's state animal? Any idea why you're on the state flag? I've seen this type before. Cute, but not a talker. Clearly, I needed someone with some more specialized knowledge.
My name is Jim Leary, and I'm a retired faculty at UW-Madison in Folklore and Scandinavian Studies.
Leary studies the history and culture of Midwestern people. He said the whole Wisconsin badger thing comes down to
lead mining in the late 1820s and into the 1830s and beyond in the southwest part of the state.
Yeah, lead mining.
In lead mining, there were little holes that people started to dig in and sometimes abandon. and they were called, you know, they were sometimes called badger holds. But the prevailing story is that the early settlers actually lived in these holes, and that's where the name came from.
Turns out, though, that probably never happened. Leary says historians can't find any reliable evidence that miners actually lived in their badger holes. But either way, the name stuck. So, to boil it down, the badger is Wisconsin's state animal because 200 years ago, people here went digging for lead. And actual badgers also dig holes?
He is a great digger. He's got those really long front claws that are fantastic at digging burrows really quickly.
Back at the zoo, curator Jess Thompson had plenty of other good facts about real badgers like Bucky and his cousins in the wild.
There are a couple different types of badgers. There are badgers that live in Europe, European badgers. There's obviously the honey badger that many people know about in Africa. And there are some badgers that live in Asia. And most of those species are much more social. But our North American badgers are really solitary.
Thompson says badgers are ferocious hunters.
They also have jaws that are really hard to dislocate because of the way that they're attached in their skull. So because of that, they're able to attach really firmly onto their prey.
But aside from hunting prowess and a shared history of digging, is there something about badgers that makes them a good symbol for Wisconsin?
Definitely. Yeah, these guys are so resourceful, and they're known for being tough and being able to make it through a lot of different circumstances, so a lot of great qualities.
John K. Wilson is a digital editor at WPR and is the co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. And this story came to us from a listener question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, bankruptcies hit new lows in 2021. We'll find out why and if that might last. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Both individual and commercial bankruptcies in the United States were down in 2021. According to industry data from the company Epic Bankruptcy, the number of filings fell to their lowest numbers in at least the last 15 years, in spite of the pandemic. We're looking at why that might have been, what it means for the economy. Mary Eshelbach-Hansen is with us, professor of economics at American University, co-author of the book Bankrupt in America, A History of Debtors, Their Creditors, and the Law in the 20th Century. Mary, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think might have been driving this decline in bankruptcy filings last year?
Right. So most of us who study and watch bankruptcy were not terribly surprised by the decline in bankruptcy last year, because most people go to court because somebody is trying to collect money from them. And the most important somebody's out there are mortgage holders, right? So banks who have your mortgage, you're not paying, they try and collect by foreclosing. But most places, and in fact, the federal government for a while had a mortgage foreclosure moratorium during the pandemic. So banks couldn't go out and try and force people to pay. And so people didn't go to court.
Are we going to have, so I like this as good economic news for last year, but does that mean we're going to be playing catch up as those foreclosures that might have happened last year happen maybe this year instead?
So that's a good question. Certainly collections have resumed in most places, and that will increase bankruptcy rates somewhat. But there are two things to think about. One is all that stimulus money that came out of the federal government last year, right? The stimulus helped keep GDP from tanking for sure. It didn't have so much a direct short-term effect on bankruptcies because bankruptcies are driven by collections, but the stimulus may have a good effect going forward. And that's because during the pandemic, partly because of the stimulus, people took out fewer new loans, they built up less debt, and they saved more. In fact, during the pandemic, the savings rate was twice as high as sort of the average before the pandemic. So the drawdown of debt and the extra savings should keep the number of filings lower than you might think. I won't say they're going to be low, but lower than you might think.
Now, the mortgage thing, I think of mostly for individuals. I know businesses hold mortgages too, I suppose, and that individual stimulus might have been helping individual people save that money. How about the business side of things? Why are we seeing fewer businesses filing for bankruptcy last year?
Right. So, of course, a big chunk of the pandemic went to businesses to keep them afloat during the pandemic, right? It wasn't just the stimulus checks you and I got, but also businesses got those loans from the SBA and other agencies. And so that kept them afloat for the most part. But actually the biggest difference, both during the pandemic and all the time, is that when businesses close, they're not as likely to leave a whole big pile of unpaid debt hanging around. So they don't go bankrupt. Bankrupt and closing are not the same thing, right? So lots of businesses closed over the pandemic for sure. But my guess would be that most of them did not have these big piles of debt.
Right. And that's an important distinction. I think a lot of times I hear bankrupt and I think, oh, that's disastrous for that individual, certainly, or for that business. Sometimes it can be a tool to allow, and I'm thinking especially of businesses here, a tool to allow a business to succeed in the future. Can you talk about that side of business bankruptcy a little?
So that's true, actually, for both individual people and for businesses. So the whole impetus of having a standing bankruptcy law in the United States was to keep the economy moving, to keep people moving. And in the 30s, especially the 1930s, there came to be a general understanding, both in Congress and in the courts and among people, that the point of bankruptcy was to provide a fresh start to people who had, for no like reasons that were their own fault, found it unable to pay their debt, right? So we call that a fresh start. And the fresh start is a really central idea and has been for the last century. It lets people pick up and move on. So there are lots of famous cases. Ford went bankrupt before he made it rich, right? Lots of other folks like that. And from the perspective of an individual person or an individual entrepreneur, the ability to wipe out that debt and start fresh has been a big part of the story.
One other part of the story I wanted to bring up is medical debt. I've looked at different studies that assign a widely varying portion of personal bankruptcies to medical debt. How big a role do you see that playing? How has that changed over the years?
Right. That is so hard to estimate, which is why you see such a range. Even in the academic literature, there's not a lot of agreement. But it helps to think about what most bankruptcies are caused by, right? So most bankruptcies are caused by a bad thing that happens to you, right? And one of those bad things is getting sick, right? One of those bad things could be becoming unemployed, either because your plant closed or sometimes because we're in a recession and unemployment is increasing generally. But in the US, it's really hard to disentangle those why people have medical debt, right? Because if you get sick, you're going to have medical debt, and then you might not be able to work, so you don't have any income to pay for it. Or if you become unemployed, you're much less likely to be insured, and then you might build up medical debt that you wouldn't have otherwise built up. And also you don't have a job, right? So it's very difficult to disentangle medical debt from any other causes of debt or of bankruptcy in general. That makes sense?
Yeah. Just in our last few moments, Mary, what are you watching for? You said it might not be as bad as a huge rebound in bankruptcy. What are the main things you're watching for just in our last half minute or so?
Yeah, sure. So the big trend long before the pandemic actually was declining bankruptcies. And the big reason for that is that the big bankruptcy reform in 2005 made it much more expensive for people to file. And so less people file. I'm curious to see if Congress comes back to the question of whether the current bankruptcy law is well structured.
Mary, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Happy to be here.
Mary Eshelbach-Hansen is a professor of economics at American University, co-author of the book Bankrupt in America, A History of Debtors, Their Creditors, and the Law in the 20th Century. She joined us for a look at last year's drop in bankruptcy filings for businesses and individuals. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Wisconsin's election maps for the state legislature. We'll find out why and what happens next in an election year. And seen any good movies lately? The Oscars are around the corner. A film expert joins the show. You could share your favorites as well. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then an economist who's a data scientist tells us how our good ideas can change the world and what pitfalls we need to avoid in order to make them work on a larger scale. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.